Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
To your Making It Worse. We're here, we're queer, who cares? I'm Elliot Glazer.
And I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott. Textual healing.
Well, you're free to sit on a dick and not get a horrible, you know, disease or infection or anything. Well, you probably still get an infection, but you're not going to get a disease because now it's free to everyone on Obamacare's PrEP. The Biden administration came through this past week and it had been classified class A, which is a requirement. A drug needs to be classified in order to be a part of Obamacare, like a part of the federal program
covered.
This drug is covered.
Fully covered, right.
But it was the Biden administration who came through and made it happen, which is really, really exciting. So now
it's really cool.
PrEP, which is the drug that blocks basically the HIV virus from, you know.
How dare you?
I'm putting the science out there in the most layman's way I can. Blocks the HIV virus from processing your body and through your body, and it was a wonderful drug that came about a couple years ago, and now it's like so easily available, which is really, really exciting.
So people use it, Alan, just to double check, people use it to avoid getting HIV, and people also use it if they have HIV, correct?
Yes.
They use
PEP if they have it.
Exactly.
Why am I asking Alan this? Elliot, go ahead.
No, PrEP is for
people who don't have HIV positive. Yes. So it's to block the HIV virus. Yeah.
Right. Yes. And it's very effective.
All right.
But I still remember when it came out, it was so exciting, obviously such a huge, such a huge advantage in queer life, but also in medicine. And I remember it was so quickly, so immediately dampered and dampened by some quote unquote sex activist or something in DC. Those guys who were like, we're Truvada whores. Yeah. It was like, oh no, can you not ruin this immediately?
It wasn't just that. It was also the cost was prohibitively.
Oh my God, enormous.
It was insane that so many people, really only people who were like those DC guys who could afford this drug could access PrEP.
Exactly, and that's right.
Now it's become, and even though, Gilead, which is the maker of the drug, the original drug, they offered a program that you could be a part of to get the drug for free or a low cost. But the problem is, and that's always exciting when a corporate or pharmaceutical company comes through and says, we've made this drug available to low income people. But the problem is, so many of those people are at a socioeconomic sort of disadvantage in terms of education, to understand the healthcare system, to understand the loops. Literally, even me, to try to get through, you had to submit like receipts for different things and upload it on the website. Right, it was like a whole process where it's like, if someone who has a middle
it's
school
like a
education,
Best Buy rebate,
exactly, they're not going to know what the fuck to do,
and
then they're
going
to be at risk. Yeah. So it's really, really exciting that the Biden administration came through and made this drug available in a very easy way for people.
Alan, have you been on PrEP? I forget.
I was, for
you
years.
Were, before you were in a relationship.
Yeah, because I was a part of Kaiser Permanente, and they made it really, really easy to access the drug. Whereas
I've never done it. I've never
been.
Never. Why haven't you done it?
I guess.
I mean, you've been on it.
I'm getting lightheaded.
That's segment three, Brent. We're not too late yet.
I know.
We'll have to explain why you're getting lightheaded at mentioning.
I guess to be totally honest with you, I know it's really expensive. I don't have a ton of sex with random people, so I was like, I don't think I need to take a drug that allows me to have, a little more peace of mind.
Yeah.
For things like this. I'm not saying this is the rationale that other people should use, But I was just like, that's a lot of money. Even if it is being covered by insurance, it's a lot of money. And it would be something that I would be using, you know, quote unquote, in my life with some infrequency. Like yeah. I would be taking it every day, but I would be truly needing it fairly infrequently. And so, yeah, I guess I just ultimately elected against it. I also recently looked into getting it, and my doctor was, because my insurance is going to change soon. And my doctor was like, don't start it and stop, because sometimes that kind of
yeah, you have to be on it.
Efficacy.
You have to be on it consistently in order for it to work. You can't, it's not like a pill that you can just take and then have sex. It has to be in your system for it to work properly.
The funny thing is that, like, you know, for you in particular, it's like, even if you don't have sex frequently, you're always plagued by the, I mean, as I was too, plagued by the danger element of it and being in a deep fear about like contracting something.
Yeah.
And so I think even if you aren't having unprotected sex often or at all,
right.
If at this point it's going to be free, I would say do it just so that it gives you peace of mind rather than like, you're sort of white knuckling yourself when you're getting tested. And
it also kind of takes away the stigma for HIV positive people, which is, a huge stigma from HIV negative people to people who are positive often is that fear of, you know, being intimate with someone who happens to be HIV positive. And the rationale, if the person who's HIV positive is taking their medication properly, they're likely undetectable. There's the chance of, this is impossible for it to happen. And that's just a reality. But for a lot of people, there is still that concern. It shouldn't be there, but it is. And PrEP is a tool to make that concern sort of dissipate.
You know what, Elliot? Maybe you're right. You know what? In fact, I'll say this. You are right. And I'm going to go start on PrEP when I get back to LA. And the very first night I start, I'm going to get barebacked in a park. Thank you so much.
Oh my God. maybe take a breath. Maybe at least drop your back.
Maybe wait like 2 weeks.
Not even joking.
Well, we are joined this week by a very good friend of the podcast, friend of ours,
years.
An amazing comedian.
Years.
For many years. We've known her for many years. Sarah Schaefer. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us this
week. Thank you so much for having me. I love you guys so much.
we love you too. How are you doing? So you are currently Zooming with us from a closet. So you actually sound fantastic.
Yeah.
The audio quality is excellent.
Yeah.
How's your life been the last like 3 or 4 vaguely post pandemic months?
It's been surreal, but good. I've just been gradually trying to get back my sea legs and all that stuff. But then now with the Delta variant, it's like, feels like
Delta Burke is fucking us up, isn't she?
It's a little step back. Yeah.
Yeah,
but
a couple delays.
A couple snags, but feeling good and catching up with family and starting to see more friends little by little and performing, which has been fun. Yeah. And
Oh, I was gonna say you had a pretty fun tweet go viral, a tweet video from your podcast, The Schaefer Shakedown.
Yeah.
And it's about comedy, but it also applies, I think, to our queer audience. And it's in a sort of indirect way, I guess. But do you mind talking about it a little bit? We'll probably add in some audio from it. But
yeah,
it got big.
Yeah, it did. I was like, I didn't realize it was going to hit people in such a visceral way.
I really
was talking in the podcast about just comedy and the comedy club, because I made a miniature comedy club. Like I actually made one.
A
1/12 a 1/12 scale comedy club. And like it took me a month.
Those. You have a lot of those, right? You collected those for years.
Yeah, I've been into miniatures and dollhouses and stuff since I was a child, but I've never made anything. So I made a miniature comedy club, painstaking detail. Like it looks real in the pictures.
Mm-hmm. And it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's called the Ha Ha Hole.
Yeah. And it was such a joy to do, but I was working on it, I was like, this will just be fun and funny and I'll do it as like a fun thing. And then it became this deep contemplation on comedy as I was working on it and like transformative. Like, and I did a podcast episode talking about the club and in it I started talking about also like there was this incident with a comedian who used a racial slur to introduce another comic and that clip went viral. And I was just talking about the stress of being in comedy and our yeah. business. And I was like, you know, one of the things that happens whenever there's a comedy controversy is they'll go, we're a family. You know, you don't talk ill of a family member. You never go against another comedian. That's against the comedian's code. We're a family. And yeah. I'm like, that is the biggest load of bullshit I've ever heard.
Yeah. We're families not, don't have codes.
Right, yeah,
we're definitely
family.
Not a family.
Like, you know, I'm like, yeah. not even the worst family is as bad as this. Yeah. Anyway, but... And so I was like, you sound like cult members. And so then I was like, oh, what if I did a commercial that was like a fake commercial that was like joining like a recruitment video for comedy? Yes. And it was just for audio, but like I recorded the video and it was just like, you know, do yeah. you, and I put it to music, like I call it like corporate training,
very upbeat.
Corporate cult music, like Nexium level, like type, yes. Yes. you know, like join comedy today, you know, like, and I kind of like, just straight up say like what you have to do, which is the hang. You have to hang out mm-hmm. for years on end. Mm. You have to like, yeah. and you don't get paid. And you know, so anyway,
I love the hang though. I got my wine.
I love the hang. Are you searching for something? Do you lack meaning in your life? A purpose? Well, there's a place for you. A place your voice will be heard. A place where everyone knows your name. Comedy. Connect with others, be a part of something, and make the world laugh. Anyone can join. Here at Comedy, we welcome all. We offer support, training, and classes. You'll learn from the masters and the truth tellers. Comedians always have each other's backs, no matter what. It's a community like no other, a family. All you have to do is just hang out. That's right, just hang out. Hang out for hours and hours, night after night, for years on end without getting paid, with people who are cruel and sometimes criminals. You need to get those people to like you. You know, and it's so incongruous with the message that is sent to us on the same, you know, same mm-hmm. In the same breath, they'll go, you know, you just got to hang out, man, for years, and you got to be cool to right. hang out with. Right. Then they'll go, but funny is funny. That's all that matters is that you're funny.
Right.
And that's such right. a lie. It's like, well, right. what does hanging out until 3 a.m. have to do yeah. with being funny? And that was a memo yeah. I didn't yeah. get until way too late. Like,
yeah. I never got it, but Brent is very good at it.
Yeah, yeah. Brent is Brent, of all three of us. Brent is, or four of us. Brent is definitely the best of.
So you're all saying I am the most alcoholic of everyone here. Yes. Yeah, very much. Thank you.
Well, no, you really got it. You really got off on sort of. I mean, there is, just to explain for anyone who isn't in comedy listening, like there is this sort of culture of. You get up for what, 15, 20 minutes, maybe, if you're lucky, for a mm-hmm. set. And then you have like an hour and a half where you're just hanging with people that you're kind of forced to be friends with because you're in the same field. But half the time half the time I always felt uncomfortable because I was around idiots.
See, I just want to add too that like, I know the reason that I'm bringing this up in particular is because it obviously struck me for a handful of reasons, but like, it really does for me apply to like being queer in a lot of ways where it feels like you're supposed to hang, you know, you're supposed to sort yeah, of like surround yeah. yourself in yeah. certain yeah. situations and atmospheres.
Bring it
all back, never, Elliot. I just never felt back. Like I wanted to, you know, mm-hmm. not that I was against it, but anyway, all of that to say that it's a really, really funny bit, but also very like,
yeah.
therapeutic
together. Right. That's interesting to hear you say that, because maybe that's why it struck such a chord with so many people, even yeah. beyond comedy, is because it talks about when you don't feel like you fit the mold of the social rules that have been set up in yes. whatever
the
scene.
Social rules, that's it.
Correct.
That you're trying yeah. to be a part of, community you're trying to be a part of, workplace you're trying to be a part
that
of.
That you get in trouble if you say, if you disagree,
yeah.
which mm-hmm. the literally is like the crux of our podcast. If mm-hmm. you yeah. disagree, like yeah. you're considered, at least in this world, it's like, are you a homophobic homophobe? Like, are you self-hating?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right,
it's like,
right.
No, I don't want to go by the quote unquote code because I don't connect to it.
Yeah. Well, and yeah. it's an in-group, out-group thing. It's a way to yes. say we're the real ones. And if you don't yes. go along with it, right. how dare yes. you right. criticize us? Then you're not real. And it's like, well, who right. decides who what's real? Who
was this
you
like club
trouble?
Membership rules?
Wait.
Yeah.
Wait, let me ask you a question real quick. And tangenting a little bit. Your album, your comedy album, Live, Laugh, Love.
So fun.
Is incredible. Everyone loves it. But I do, if you don't mind, I do want to talk about my favorite joke of yours, which I saw you do for the first time like ages ago. Mm-hmm. You talk about why your posture is bad now as an adult. Would you mind walking us through the logic?
Well, that this is from my first album, actually, Chrysalis. So if you're looking,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah, but now we got both plugged, so that's great.
right.
Live, Laugh, Love is my second album. Chrysalis is my first one. Get both. Yeah. I talk about I have bad posture because when I was younger, I had no tits and I was like so ashamed of my flat chest that like I would hunch over so that the fabric would hang like a curtain and so that maybe there would be boobs in there. I haven't thought about that joke in so long. I don't even remember really how it goes, but I talk about like how I would hunch over so that fabric would hang down and you wouldn't maybe... Yeah. It was an illusion that there were boobs in there.
I just think it also reminds me of like when you were a kid, you do these things and I'll share one in a second. You do these things that are so uncomfortable and sometimes they last with you for decades afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For Elliot, 4 or 5 decades after he graduates high school, he's still doing certain things. And for me, mine was, I was always insecure about being skinny. So I would wear
Never had that problem. Like a
hoodie pullover jacket of some kind, fleece over myself, even in like summer. So I remember being in class on a hot May day and I had my down coat on.
Still. Oh my God. That's
brutal.
And it was like really starting to get, and then I did it the other day where I was like, I was somewhere and I was like, I'm in hell because it was too hot and I had a hoodie on and it was because I was like, oh, this is like a relic of my childhood. I'm wearing it because I feel insecure.
I had the opposite of that. I always wear like either an overshirt or something because I don't want to just wear the t-shirt because it'll show my problem areas. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like it'll show like bits of fat or whatever, like things hanging off, like things you don't want to see. So I would always wear the coats to hide that as well, not to look bigger.
Yeah, but no, when I was doing that joke, women would come up to me after the show and go, you know what, I did the same thing, but because my boobs were so big that they would hunch over to, again, try to hide, try to, like, you know, not have your chest out and showing what it is you have or don't have. And I was like, wow, this really, it does start early.
That joke, I mean, I was going to say at the beginning, we've all known you for
a long time,
like since New York.
15 years, I think, for some.
Yeah, a long time. And it's what I love. I remember first seeing you in New York, and then of course, you know, being friends, and then, you know, doing your pie, like all the things you've done over the years. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've always sort of been struck by about you is you're my favorite type of comic because you take like, you're not like a punchline comic necessarily. You take like deeply personal things.
I don't have punchlines. I don't tell jokes.
You know what I mean, though? You know what I mean? Like you take real stories.
I'm not set up punchline. Yeah. I don't do one-liners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You take these real stories. And I remember doing you and Nikki Glaser's podcast like years ago. And I had just finished chemo and a friend had passed away.
I remember.
And you had also had a death in the family. And I remember us sort of on the podcast getting emotional talking about our experiences with death and illness and all of these
getting
things.
Getting emotional now.
And then, but yet somehow you finding a way to make it into comedy. And it's just, it's, you're so good at that. And your book does it, I think, really, really, really well. I pre-ordered, I read, I did the thing. And
thank you.
It's you're just one of those. How was writing the book and releasing the book during the pandemic? Obviously a personal time. Like, what was that like for you?
Well, writing the book was so, so challenging. And I know that's like the typical answer people give, but there's just no other way to describe how hellish it was. I mean, it was really difficult process. It took me 3 years and I just have never had a creative challenge like that before, personal challenge. I mean, because it was such a personal book, and I talked about things in the book that I thought I would never say publicly, and that was really scary. And then just the writing of it, the creativity of it, all of it was so hard. And then the release of it was supposed to be the reward, which would be like the book tour and press and all
the
this
Today
stuff.
Today Show,
I was really hoping to do the Today Show. I was.
Oh
I was God. Like, Jenna Bush
I remember,
is going to love this
with
book.
You about it.
Yeah, I was like, that's the goal. Hoda's going to love it. You know, and I was so excited.
Instead,
and then
would you be disappointed to get
shit.
Al Roker?
Yeah.
Would you, like, what if you showed up and you got Al?
I mean, I wouldn't give a
and
shit.
And he's like, you know what? I didn't love the book.
That's how he would be. He'd be like, interesting. It was interesting.
Edward is a crank, right? Isn't he?
Yeah,
a crank?
He's a little.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
No, I mean, he's been around forever. And, he's the one where I think he's just done with everybody's bullshit sometimes. I've been doing this for 85 years.
Sorry, Sarah, go ahead.
No, but I had all these things I was looking forward to having happen as the light on the end of the tunnel when it was in my darkest moments. I was like, just remember how great it's going to be to get this out in the world. And then most of it didn't happen. All of it, and even things that were still going, they were still having talk shows and all that during the pandemic. But what I found was that it was way harder to get booked because one, every celebrity was stuck at home, bored out of their goddamn minds. So suddenly shows were able to book bigger stars because it was just Zoom. And so
Matthew McConaughey on Jenny Jones or whatever.
I'm competing against
on Jenny Jones. What era are you in?
Oh, you son of a bitch.
Yeah. And so I was just really disappointed. And, I had a publicist who I hired and she really worked her fucking ass off trying to, she was just like, and she was like, oh, this place is interested. They're going to cover. Da, da, da. And then the emails would just stop. And it was, some of it was pandemic. People were like, I've got kids. I can't write you back. There was a lot, we all have been seeing the effects of labor during this people being like, I'm fucking fed up with my job.
I saw Jean Smart on a lot of talk shows. shows. She took one of your spots, I bet.
She did. But I will say the book coming out was, I have to say the process of writing the book and sharing it with my family alone was one of the most life-changing things I've ever been through that I'm not fully the full-term healing and effect of it all personally.
Yeah.
But then to have people read it, which when people are like, oh, I haven't read your book yet. I'm like, good, wait. Because what's happening is it's a longer commitment. Mm-hmm. And it lasts forever. And so I keep now it's trickling now, but I keep getting texts and messages from people being like, I just finished your book. This is what it meant to me. Thank you for writing it. And so I'm like, ooh, space. It's like a slow drip of positive feedback that I'm getting. I'm like, when people are like, oh, I haven't read it yet. I'm like, good, wait, because when you finally do and you send me a message, I might be having a really bad day. And I like to save it up.
I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was great. It's called Grand, just for everyone listening. Yeah. It's called Grand, you can order it now everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, that actually rings a bell because I often will get messages from people who listen to the podcast and they'll say, oh my God, Brent, I love you so much. I hate Alan. Listening to Alan. I hate listening to Elliot.
No, the correct responses are, I'll get messages from the show and these two, Elliot and Brent, will be up in arms immediately being like, are they angry? What did we piss off? Are they pissed off?
Are we
canceled yet?
Yeah.
And I'm like, guys, you're not that big. Don't worry.
They're just saying hi. Yeah.
Exactly. That is really funny. Go ahead, Elliot.
Yeah, your comedy album Live, Laugh, Love obviously has a lot to do with the, I guess, what do you call it? Driftwood?
Inspirational quotes on rustic pieces of driftwood in multiple fonts.
Which Elliot loves. Elliot loves that shit.
We bonded about this. I think inspirational quotes on driftwood are the most depressing, they're the most soul-sucking, depressing possible things anybody could buy, because it's you're trying to buy a personality and it's like, it's so depressing to me.
It's so awful. And that joke started years ago. Now I'm seeing on TikTok, a lot of people are making jokes about it. I'm like, first. I was there first. Years ago, this is what started me writing the joke was, my husband, Scott, a sort of distant family member, he was at their house and he took a video of all the signs that she had. There were so many of them. And they were
oh, that's
he was
so funny.
Counting how many there were. He was like, one, too. He was like going around the house, and I was like, and that's when I started making jokes about it on stage, because I was like, I gotta talk about this.
I've always found there are like three different types of people who have like the theme of what they have on those things in their house. It either is family, which is my mother. They're all about family. Or it's love. Like it's all about like love and peace and all that shit. Or it's about God. Like those are the three.
Or it's about those three.
Oh yeah, those are the funny ones.
I think that these pieces of fake driftwood have like really found their way into it, permeated into society in a lot of ways, and that they used to be decor. Now they're on TikTok as people being self-aware enough to make fun of them. And yet obviously they still, for the most part, are completely, the humor of it is lost on, I think, most people who buy it. But I've really tried to, like, my mom is intelligent and has good taste, but I've made sure to steer her clear of ever like getting anything like that. She had like a shirt that said something where it was like, okay, like that's not bad, but like I don't, you know, like the I'm really creeped out by like the mommy juice. It's wine o'clock. Like
deals with talk about mommy cheese. You always talk about how Baby Bell's mommy cheese. I've always loved that summary. Mommy cheese. Yeah.
When Elliot moved into his apartment, I remember him mentioning this, turning his bathroom into all of those signs, like just having like an assortment of all
like
those signs,
like making it like losing all the like losing every drop of like earnest. From because you have so many.
I was looking to go to a Cracker Barrel just to buy that shit to put in your bathroom.
Well, I actually took that and made that like my office when I was working on a show that was a long-term gig. I was like, you know what, like these offices are so like bland and whatever. I think I got like 30 or 40 of them.
That's great.
At random. They were horrible. And I just put them all in one place. Meaningless.
It's so funny.
So funny.
And I think the grossest one too is, I was going to say, like the one that creeps me out the most that this is the one that I've had to steer my mom away from buying or buying into is like, to the moon and back. I hate that phrase, to the moon and back. And I swear to God, my friend's parents had, she had a bunch of them in her bathroom, her mom did. And then she literally had the other one that I hate so much, always kiss me goodnight, but she had it over the toilet. I don't know.
I mean,
so funny.
There's so many bad ones, and like there's some that are like weirdly long, like it's a full paragraph. It's like, in this house we, you know, it's those things.
In grandma's house.
The kitchens are meant for dancing. It's like, actually they're meant for cooking.
I hate it.
It's almost like they took the place of those inspirational posters.
That is so funny.
They have. Yes, they absolutely have. I actually, the worst one I found was actually one that says, it doesn't even make sense. It was like, I don't do Pilates. I do pie and lattes.
That's a stretch. I'll be honest though, there is one, I think I've said it on the podcast once before, there's one that melts my heart and it gets me every time when I see it. Shoot for the moon, because even if you miss, you'll land among the stars. And I've always loved it. I think it's so cute.
Yeah. I love how Brent is secretly like a suburban mom. He secretly is.
Insane.
Like,
I think that's a sweet sentiment.
Brent watches beheading videos and then he looks up cards.
This bitch has a dream catcher over her left shoulder and she's ragging on motivational quotes. Dream catcher.
Well, you know what? It's permeating to captions on Instagram. And you know, I love Bo Burnham's White Woman's Instagram because it's just so spot on.
Perfect.
Captions on Instagram have started to really irritate the shit out of me. And some people who I love dearly do it. And I'm just like, I don't know how to tell them like all the feelings. This human is everything.
Or when somebody tries to like downplay romance by being like, I've been with this idiot for a year now. It's like,
nerd. Will say that is fully Michael and I. That is fully my boyfriend.
The thing is, it's stuff that I probably did because we're writers and comedians, so we're just like a little further ahead on language.
We've done it before, but and, we know now, like
right. So we've done it before, but now it's mainstream and it's like hacky sounding to us. So I don't criticize like family or friends that do it because I'm just like, well, you're just. It's not fair to hold. Right, you're normal. I'm
Like, you're a normal person. I'm fucked up.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and like, but just the like all the feels and the things. I ate all the meats and all the cheeses.
Hyperbole,
right? All right. So we talked about the most important things: your book, your albums, and everything. But I do want to ask you a deep cut about your life that I was always, and you know, you remember this about me. I was always jealous that you were a writer originally, way back when, for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Yeah.
And I was always so jealous. I think to this day, having done comedy for a long
time. It's a good gig.
My dream job is still writing trivia questions. I love it. What was that like? Did you have fun?
I did. It was much harder than I thought it was going to be. Because you get in and like, it's not what I thought it would be at all. And like when people hear, oh, you wrote for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? They don't understand that you wrote the questions. I don't think people put it together that people have to, they don't pull the questions out of the Trivial Pursuit box.
Right.
Like they, someone wrote those. So, it was way more challenging than I thought because one, when I came in to the show, I wrote for one season and, I came in and it had already been on the air for like 10 years. And now it had been a daytime, show for years where, meaning it was on every day. So lots of episodes had been done and that means lots of questions had been asked.
Was Meredith Vieira the host at that point?
Meredith was the host at that point.
I love her.
She is the best. And we didn't even get to meet her. She's like someone you get drunk with. I met her briefly at the wrap party. The writers were not allowed to even be in the same building as production because $1 million
is
on the line.
That's pretty standard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
pretty standard.
It's like a legal thing.
We were sequestered from production and we had, like, I got to go to the studio once, you know, and see it and stuff, but I wasn't allowed to, like, be a part of it.
Wow.
That's insane. We had to do all our work at the office so that we could be logged in to the computer. Like you couldn't work from home. It was all proprietary software that they used. And it was this huge database and you could not ask a question. You could not write a question that had already been in the database. So the database had over 100,000 questions in it.
Oh my God. So you show up to work and we
had a quota and ours was like 10 to 12 questions a day, which doesn't sound like a lot.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's a lot. That sounds like a lot.
I was warned, they were like, the first 2 weeks, you're going to be breezing through it. You're going to be like, I got all these ideas and it's going to be great. And then 2 weeks in, you're going to want to kill yourself because you don't know what to do. And the clock is ticking and you've got to write 12 questions by the end of the day. And they have to be questions that, you know, get used. And so like, you know,
How far ahead of shooting were they picked at random after you wrote them?
Well, what the head writer would prepare what's known as stacks, and they were the stack of questions. Now, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire's format has changed many times over the years where they've mixed up values, you don't know, but the traditional was $100 question up to $1 million, and the head writer would prepare a stack per contestant, you know, that would come to the show, and that, you know, I guess it was 10 questions maybe. My assignment was to write a lot of the 100 or really low value questions, which are actually really hard to write because it's hard to write an easy question because when you know the answer, it's hard to tell how hard it is. And they would be like, your questions are too hard. And I'm like, God fucking damn it, you know, or they'd be like, but they also had like a philosophy of like, okay, remember, this is a show that regular people watch. So they want to have a play along feeling. They want to feel like they can win. And so you don't want to ask questions about things that are so obscure. Even if the nerd playing gets it right, the person at home feels left out. So they were like, for instance, Sarah, you're really good at art questions. Ask art questions. But they were like, but there's only about 10 paintings that everybody knows. Think about it. So Mona Lisa, The Scream, like truly there are only 5 to 10 paintings or pieces of artwork that everybody knows about. So they were like,
that's wild.
So you're trying to write new questions about these common topics. So that was very challenging.
What painting is based on the Julia Roberts movie?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. There was so many ways to get into it. And there was allowed to be a few topical questions, but they had to be evergreen kind of, which is a term we all know being in TV. Yeah. Evergreen means that it doesn't feel dated by the time it gets on the
air. It doesn't
really
age.
And so...
Right.
It like Gene Smart, like Gene Smart.
Yeah, nothing about Banksy. Banksy.
Yeah. Well, you got to have, like, if it was topical, it had to be something really big, like where were the Olympics in whatever year? You know, like you couldn't get too obscure. So everybody would, whoever got there first, the day that something big had happened, got to write that question. Like people would, the other writer would like race in and be like,
get in at 6
a.m. So and so won the election. You know, who became the president? You know, like you wanted to be the one that wrote that question.
Like a job like that and like you talking about a job like that is I think a lot of comedians, like especially new comedians, they think, oh, well, I have to get up on stage and just do this. And there's not many fields that you can go in to sort of get writing work and to get things in. And like, there's actually like a lot of different ways comedians are used for different purposes, you know.
Every
what I mean?
Single word you see uttered on TV was written by someone for the most part, and those,
including the Kardashians.
That's right.
Writer, there are writers on every reality show you see. You know, the Survivor. Who's Jeff? Whatever his name is. The
Probst.
Jeff Probst.
Probe.
That guy.
Jeff Daddy Probst.
He wasn't.
That's what I call him.
He wasn't. Off the cuff, somebody wrote all that shit for him to say, and so you know there is a lot of writing opportunities, you know, in for comedians and even for stuff you wouldn't even think it would be funny. TV producers love hiring comedians because we are writers. Yeah. We write for ourselves, and they want that edge. They want the sense of humor, especially in a lot of comedians
cadence,
go into
personalized.
They go into advertising, writing for ads and stuff, and that's a whole other skill.
Of course, that's when you fail. But yes.
Yeah, exactly. But you also own two homes.
Exactly.
Then you have a house, you have a mortgage and children.
Yeah, exactly.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
The easiest is to just go to Sarah Schaefer 1. You just guess how it's spelled. It'll come up. right. And Sarah Schaefer 1 across all platforms in my podcast, The Schaefer Shakedown.
And your new book called Grand.
Yeah.
And your comedy album.
Oh, buy it.
Live,
read
laugh,
it. It's
love.
So good. It's so good.
I love you guys so much.
Yeah,
I miss
too.
You.
We so love much. You.
Thank you so much for doing the podcast.
And another thing.
So we mentioned before in the first segment, Brent
demonstrated. Didn't even mention. He demonstrated it.
Demonstrated getting lightheaded at the thought of taking prep or just the discussion of prep. And you've probably heard on this podcast many times Brent referencing getting lightheaded, and he's always sort of fanning himself. There should be a historical context to this in that Brent has what we call a vasovagal response.
Which we're the only podcast in the world that uses that word.
Frequently talks about vasovagal response.
The only place in the world that does that.
Yeah. So basically Brent gets lightheaded from stuff. And he and I shared that for many, many times, but yours is a lot worse than mine, I would say. And I think it's important for our listeners to understand what and why you get lightheaded and dizzy and could pass out from things that to some, or maybe even most, would find benign.
Pretty innocuous. Yeah. So it is like an automatic response that some people have. I actually looked it up. Some people have it with blood. Some people have it with urination. Yeah. Some people have it with other kind of like stressful stimulus.
Do they just sit down to pee so they don't look at it?
I literally wonder the urination thing. I was like, how do you
Yeah.
How does it work if you pass out when you pee?
Yeah. And TGI Friday's bathrooms are disgusting.
Like colostomy bags or something. But so yeah. It all started for me when I remember the first time it happened. I was watching the movie Stand By Me. Great film. And in the film, I'm in elementary school, by the way, at the time. And in the film, there's a scene where the boys are swimming in like a river or some pond, and they come out of the river, and the one, this is going to sound sexual, but it's not. The one opens up his briefs and he pulls leeches out of his briefs, his swimsuit, and there's blood on his hand. So obviously the insinuation was that leeches were sucking, I guess, his balls. I don't know. And I mean, I'm like second, third grade. And I remember seeing that and instantly being like, I wish I hadn't seen that. That's an awful, awful, awful thought. And I couldn't get it out of my head.
Oh, wow.
And then, I got up to leave and I passed out in like the foyer of the house. So that was the first time it happened. And it subsequently
happened.
You passed
out?
I like
Stand
officially...
By Me made you pass out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the ball blood scene. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
it
that's
did.
Fair. Yeah. That's totally fair.
I mean, I love how Alan is like this like sweet, wonderful liberal man.
It blows me away.
Of everyone,
it blows
and he's like vicious with me when it comes
no,
to like this.
No, you just
response.
Take it viciously because
he's
you're sensitive.
He's abusive.
You're sensitive.
But it happened in high school. Like if I got really bad paper cuts, I would pass out. And it happened on a plane recently. Like I was watching, like the woman next to me was watching a horror film and a guy got stabbed. It's specifically in the arm and he bled to death in the movie. And I passed out on the plane. Oh, I had to get down. I had to curl into a ball and get down, you know, wedge myself to get my head under my knees. Cause that's what you're supposed to do.
Did you keep your mask on?
I did keep my mask on. And you know, you're drenched in sweat and like, I get slowly like cold sweat. So it's just such a nightmare.
Have you been like, I'm sure there's like therapy for something like this, or there's like some sort of, you know, like way to cause it seems like a way that, you know, certain people handle like blood. Well, blood's a great one where
my mom has the same thing, by the way.
They have to mentally like go to therapy to like process being able to handle some things in public. You know what I mean?
It happens infrequently enough where like, obviously, you know, I bring it up in the podcast, like when I'm just vaguely squeamish with something and then it's like my way of trying to change the topic. But like, it's pretty rare that it happens where I'm like, oh, I'm in a really bad place and I need to in public, like get down on my knees. Like that's only happened a handful of times in my life.
But what is it about like something, I mean, when we talk about stuff, we even reference anal sex or
like
we
fisting.
Talk about PrEP. No. I mean, we talk about even more benign stuff. Literally, like we say PrEP or like you said the other day, you were watching a documentary and they used the term lover and that made you lightheaded. Like, where do you get
just,
like, even
it's
like
just reminiscent of an era and a time. And, you know, anything that's reminiscent of the 80s kind of freaks me out because like every documentary
like,
about gay life
jump.
In the 80s. But yeah, every documentary about gay life in the 80s is about AIDS. And
what
so
what is
whenever,
it about AIDS? Like what, I mean, what, like, is it the blood? Like, that's what I don't
Yeah,
I,
what,
I don't
explain
think
what, where that comes from, because
I'm getting warm.
If it makes you feel better, I'll mention too, that we simultaneously, or maybe not at the same time, but around the same time, watched this documentary in the earlier days of Netflix called Gay Sex in the 70s.
Yeah.
And Alan, you must have seen it, right?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a pretty like, you know, it's, I mean, I was like, oh,
standard
cool.
Like doc.
It's a standard documentary that I thought was going to be about like free love, you know, like sort of like free love before the AIDS epidemic happened. And for this, I couldn't exactly tell you why, but I had the same response as Brent where I could not finish it because they would talk about the way they talked about sort of promiscuity and like sex and like in dark trucks in the meat packing district and just the way that
that's
it just
hot.
Happened anywhere was too, like I understand it. I was like it would make me lightheaded at the thought of I guess the thought of like danger maybe or bodies.
Really,
but even the thought now of and I share this with Brent too, when somebody even I'm not squeamish about the idea of anal sex or anything like that, but when you start talking about the biology of it, the how things work, the human, it's like I can't hear it. I can't hear about nerve endings. I can't hear about things. I can't hear about the technicality.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's so like not real.
It doesn't faze you at all.
Like it's yeah. just not, it's just not like, I don't see it as like an attachment of me or like something infallible about me or like, I don't see it. I don't take it personally. It seems very sort of like discovery.
Far away.
Yeah.
There's also like some nuance where like there are certain sensitive parts of the body that make me extra squeamish. Like sure. lips,
oh, like what?
Lips, fingers, fingernails.
Yes. You know, fingernails butt, I can relate to.
Butt balls. And like, so things like that. So when people talk about like something related to those areas and bleeding, like if you told me like a character in a movie got stabbed in the gut, couldn't care less. Doesn't bother me. But for some reason, the arm really bothered me. And like pulling leeches out of your balls was like just so fundamentally disturbing. And the same thing, whew, boy, here we go. The same thing is when we talk about HIV, we're talking about getting it via, you know,
Yeah, he can't even handle that.
I can't.
It's fine. But the duality there is that you watch gore videos, you watch beheading
videos. Yeah, you watch beheading. You watch all these videos that are like...
Also, the thing I understand the least is that for somebody who's like, who has like such severe reactions to like fingers and blood, you love latex gloves.
Yeah.
Which to me feel like the most, literally the most medicinal, like they're so tight, the texture's so odd, but they smell. Love them. How do you love them? And then also
the glove.
Yeah, how do you love them, but then also not have the ability to like look at a paper cut? It's just fascinating.
It is. It's very weird. I totally get what you're saying. I think I've just always liked form-fitting gloves. For some reason, every time I go to the dentist, these guys know because I will send them a text of me wearing a glove in the dentist chair.
there's gloves at Target. Oh, when we were at Target last, I sent you a picture of the gloves. Like it's a thing.
Yeah, that's a waste of money. I take them when I'm at the dentist.
What does the dentist say when you ask him for one or her?
I usually sneak it
right, not in the room. Even weirder. Yeah.
The only thing that I have that would make me squeamish, I guess. No, I can't even think of that. I was gonna say fingernails, like clipping toenails and stuff. But that doesn't really make me squeamish, actually.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think where being gay in particular, or a gay man, where like giving blood or having blood taken or any of or the exchange of fluids, like that can be difficult. But also the thing that I'll never understand because I've seen one porn by accident with a rosebud.
Rosebud. Yeah.
And I'm like, how? I literally cannot wrap my head around that.
Alan, fisting. Could you explain it?
Yeah, I can.
Oh no, we don't have to explain it. We get it.
Maybe you're right.
You don't have to explain what a rosebud is. I'm just saying, like, when you're dealing with butt stuff, like obviously as a gay person, a gay man, that comes into the picture.
Well, and that in particular is extreme. That is extreme. Let's be real. That's not
saying
rosebuds.
That's not a normal occurrence of anal sex.
I know, but the fact that that has been, that is easily accessible. And same thing with fisting. There was once a music video by a gay artist whose name I forget, but the video was on Vimeo only, which I didn't realize was like where this type of stuff could exist.
Yeah.
And there was a scene where he was with a fisting scene that was real. And I wholeheartedly, I have no judgment, but
of course.
It's really, truly, I get lightheaded thinking about the dynamics and the biology of it.
Now that's the opposite response that I have, because even though I'm not necessarily into that, I don't know, rosebud's a different story, that's taking it too far, but the fisting one, I'm like, well, that's, I mean, it's almost like a Tetris game. It's like, how does that work? I want to know how it works,
and I want to pass out thinking about how it works. I don't want to know how it works.
That's funny, but
Brent, how do you, I mean, also don't reveal this if you don't want to, but like, how does this then play into like
your sex life?
Sex when you've also had you've had kidney stones, which is insane too.
I did. I always say passing my kidney stone was the only badass thing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Because it was really, really horrifying. But well, you know, to be quite frank with you, you know, we've talked about how I'm certainly, I think, a lot more skittish when it comes to penetrative anal sex than Alan, and way, 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 way more than Elliot.
Yeah.
And so, and it's absolutely played into horrible anxieties that I have.
How do you even prepare? Like, how do you do that?
Well, I mean, I could, of course, do it. Yeah. You know, and Devin and my sister and brother, brother and sister-in-law are not allowed to listen to this. I mean, I can do it, but yeah, it has to be like comfortable and right, and like, and if it doesn't go right, it's like we're done.
It tends to be nerve-wracking for you.
I guarantee you that he's whispering like, you know, things about like World War, or no, he's whispering things about the Supreme Court into your ear. Just Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, a little bit deeper. Helena Kagan, deeper.
Read me the Bostock opinion. Yeah.
That's your nickname for anal sex.
What would your aunt say?
Brent, what would your Aunt Ramona say about something she heard today?
Let's just say I've been very fortunate, and I never had to lean over to hide tiny boobs. That's all I'm going to say.
My Aunt Joanne would say, what's so wrong with Rosebud? That's my friend's nickname. Like, don't Google it. Don't Google it. How about Aunt Anne?
My Aunt Anne would say, the only vasovagal response I have is to a diet.
All right. Oh my God, well, thanks for listening. Yeah. I'm Elliot Glazer.
I am Mr. Brent Sullivan on Instagram.com.
And I am H. Rosebud Scott. Juicy rose.
You're making Elliot mad.